Okay, welcome all to the hashtag Blue and Green podcast with Major Cecil Davis. I am your host, Major Davis, retired U.S. Air Force. The mission of this show is to foster an open communication channel between civilian law enforcement officers and military armed personnel so that events of January 6th, 2021 never happen again. Our motto at hashtag Blue and Green is Amor Civitatis. For those Latin buffs, love of community. Today's topic speaks directly to the heart of what hashtag Blue and Green is all about. The successful collaboration of the work and missions of the Blue, our law enforcement partners, and Green, our military partners. Our guest today is an 11-year veteran of the U.S. Army, having served four tours of duty downrange, that is in Iraq, and after active duty, served with the Macon County, Alabama Sheriff's Department. He is Jamal Darren Davis. Welcome, Mr. Davis, to our show. Now, I would like everyone to know that I know Mr. Davis very well. As a matter of fact, you can say that I was there when he was born. So I've known him for a long time. I've watched him over the years become quite a young man, patriot, citizen, and quite a father, four children. Three young boys, like getting, and a little daughter's been blessed a little over a year ago. Quite the father, too. However, at this time, I would like for Mr. Davis to introduce himself to our listening audience. Ladies and gentlemen, former Staff Sergeant, U.S. Army, Jamal Davis.
Thank you, Major. I appreciate that introduction. I really don't know how to follow that introduction. you pretty much hit the nail on the head, but my name is former Staff Sergeant Jamal Davis, U.S. Army, 11 years, 9 months, four tours in Iraq. That's 51 months in country. I deployed in 03, 04, 05, 06, 07, 09, 10, 11. I did, after that, after I was out the military, I did serve with the Macon County Sheriff's Department. Started out as a corrections officer, then deputy sheriff. Done a little bit of what people like to call bounty hunting, but the proper term is bail enforcement agent also. So I've done a multitude of different things outside of the military. You know, I've also worked with a certain local politicians there in Macon County also. I worked in the automotive sales industry as well. So, I mean, I've kind of got a well-rounded background from different experiences and trying to make the adjustment to the civilian world after the military. hit the nail on the head, you know, four kids, married to my beautiful wife, Dealandra Davis. And we have a 18-month-old daughter, a 8-year-old son. We also have a 13-year-old son and a 15-year-old son as well.
Yeah. You bet. Well, like I said, I know that keeps you pretty busy though, but we do appreciate, first of all, let me say right off the top that we appreciate your service. Because you went at a very unique time. And we'll talk about that, too. But I'm just curious, at what point in your life did you know that you wanted to go off and the life path would be active duty military? At what point did you consider that?
Actually, I kind of knew I was military bound from an early age. I mean, my father was in the Air Force 20 years, B-52 radar navigator. And watching his career kind of really influenced my decision. And to what I wanted to do. I knew it was going to be something military related. And at the time, I guess I was really bent because I was watching my dad, who's in the Air Force. So I was kind of determined to go to the Air Force at an early age. But then I think the switch happened when I got into high school and to the JROTC program. And that kind of swung my decision to go the Army route. But I was still bent on military service. After that, what really made up my mind was the day September 11th. When September 11th happened, I was fully committed to serve at that point, too. That just really, you know, really did do everything to sway my decision on a military career at that point. And then, a matter of fact, after that, November 8th was my first day in service.
You bet. I think that was at basic training at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. But it's interesting because a lot of people think since you had completed high school, of course, I think you were graduating class the year 2000. So you brought in the millennium with your graduating class. But a lot of people wondered, and they wondered, you know, that maybe he had already started the process. 9/11 happened, then he was caught. You actually started your process after 9/11.
Correct. Yeah. Oh,
you bet. Okay. Yeah. And see, and that speaks a lot to the patriotism that was being felt at the time. Now, it's interesting, you're going active duty. I know we have a pretty prominent National Guard unit here in Tuskegee-Macon County area, which, of course, where we are. And I thought about it. Had you ever thought about going military police? Because we have a military police detachment. They were actually deployed downrange as well. And several prominent citizen soldiers, you were called citizen soldiers with the National Guard, are in the National Guard unit. So I was curious, were you ever influenced by the fact that they're here, they're now, they're local, and maybe the military police piece?
Yeah, I did consider that, believe it or not, because I was really trying to figure out what I wanted to do in the Army. You know, when you join, everybody says, hey, I'm joining the Army, right? And very few people actually know what they want to do in the Army, right? So that was part of the decision process also. It was like, what do I want to do? And then having that local unit home kind of did, you know, did really play into the factor. I think what really happened, though, was when I got to the recruiting station, I was talking to my recruiter, and he was like, hey, you know, have you ever thought about combat arms? And I was like, well, I do want to do something combat related. I said, so, you know, what do you got? And the first thing he told me about was artillery, field artillery. And so I came into the Army as a 13 Bravo 30. You know, I did my basing AIT, as you said, at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And after that, I went to airborne school. I ended up hurting my knee in airborne school. So I didn't make it through airborne school and go to Fort Bragg like I was supposed to. I ended up going to, I think, which was a destined path for me anyways. I ended up going to Fort Lewis, Washington. And I was a member of the 1st Striker Brigade that was stood up there with the 3rd Brigade 2ID. And I actually made it right to the station, right to Fort Lewis when they were training at Yakima training facility. And I was able to go out and do that training with those guys, train up for the rest of that year. Then we went ahead and kicked off into the deployment mode and went straight to Iraq with those strikers. So I know I gave you a little bit more than what you're looking for in that question, but just kind of showing you the path that, you know, seeing, you know, and growing up around that presence of a military presence, it does kind of like stir your decision on what you want to do.
You bet. Yeah, you'd mentioned JROTC. Of course, that's Junior ROTC. That's done in high school. I think a lot of people are probably familiar with that acronym, JROTC. But now you had a very interesting JROTC or Junior ROTC commander. That was Colonel Flowers. He proudly wore his uniform, and I think he had the patch of the Screaming Eagles, which is, of course, the 101st Airborne. And also with him being such an imposing presence, and he's already been commended on that. Whenever he walks into a room, he commands attention. I thought about it. I said, maybe that may have had some influence into you wanting to go combat arms, because he was actually I think he was in the rank. He retired lieutenant colonel. So he made his way up through the rank, but he proudly wore that 101st Airborne patch. So I wondered if that influenced you to go into combat arms.
That did. Colonel Flowers definitely was a great mentor in high school. He was also a Ranger, and that definitely helped influence my decision as well to take the combat arms route. You know, I said, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this to the best of my ability. And that's the attitude I take with everything in life. So with that being said, you know, seeing somebody that was coming from that combat arms background and seeing, you know, growing up with the military presence in the home and seeing, you know, my dad being a combat pilot, you know, I mean, that's just, I mean, you know, that really does, you know, it kind of gives you no other choice on what to do in the military. You know, it couldn't do anything not combat related.
Okay. But knowing your dad the way I do, I know he didn't twist your arm. So, no. But it's curious. I did mention about the military police thing, because again, I'm trying to stay around the theme of, you know, hashtag blue and green. And I thought that'd be an excellent tie-in. But when I remember when you did not make it through parachute training, jump school over at Fort Benning. I thought about it. I said, well, maybe, and I know your mother wanted it too, maybe you get into the military police branch and be right here at Tuskegee. I guess that would have been too close to home, but see, that would have tied into blue and green. You would have been active duty, but you also been with the law enforcement as well. But I guess that was just a pipe dream, and that didn't work out. But we're proud of what happened with you did. Like you say again, you were a pioneer in taking the strikers over to downrange. And I know that they certainly served their function there. You know, it's interesting. You stopped active duty, you know, at 11 years. And, you know, I know that was a hard decision to make because, again, I think you had mentioned about, you know, your sons were growing up. You had been deployed 4 times in 11 years. Almost virtually half of your active duty time was spent downrange or deployed. And I know that you came up with a kind of a really hard decision. And the reason why I point you up as being a good veteran, you know, and also being a good patriot at the time, something significant was about to happen with your unit when you had already made your decision to separate. Well, what happened with your unit when you were just about to separate?
Yeah, I was actually, you know, so I'll give you kind of the background to that whole situation. Basically what happened was my kids were my two oldest sons at the time. And I just had my youngest son born into the world at the same time. So my daughter wasn't in the picture just yet. She came in the picture, you know, years later. But having 3 kids and there were some significant things in life that was going on at the time. You know, I really won't get into that.
Okay.
But there are some significant things that were going on in the family situation at that point.
Okay.
And my, you know, it really took a lot to make that decision. To be honest with you, if I didn't have kids, I would have rolled it out for the full 20. And I'm pretty sure I probably would stay longer than that. But with kids in the decision process and you know, the family situation is a split situation at that point for, you know, to not really go into the whole situation with that, but it was just a split situation, you know, so I had to take a look at the entire scenario and say, hey, you know, and as a good leader does, you know, a leader steps back, looks at the situation and then makes a decision on, okay, here's what we need to do. And that's exactly what I did. And I say, well, I said, I this is a hard decision to make, but I have to, you know, I gotta step out so that I can make sure that my kids are taken care of, and make sure that everything's goes good with that situation. After I made that decision and I went ahead and started on my paperwork to get out in the military, and I think I was right at 88 days out. Right. So I just broke that 90-day barrier. My unit came down on orders to Afghanistan. And
how'd you feel about that?
Yeah. And I really, really wanted to go. And believe me, I talked to my unit and they said, man, you've already signed your deck statement, which is a declination of service. That's what you sign when, because I was on an indefinite reenlistment, meaning that pretty much I'm at the knees of the Army at that point and staying as long as I want. But when you sign a deck statement, you're declining the rest of your military service. So that's what you have to sign to get out the Army and ETS. And I had signed that deck statement already. And the unit came down literally like a couple days later on orders to go to Afghanistan. I mean, it was like, well, it was rumored. The rumor had started that they were coming down on orders to go to Afghanistan just a couple days later. And I tried everything I could in my power to, you know, to try to change that because I had never been to Afghanistan. I really wanted to go, you know, four tours
in spite
Iraq,
of what was going on.
Right. Exactly. You know, but 4 tours in Iraq, you know, I've seen all the facets of war. I've seen, you know, when the war first kicked off over there, you know, I've seen, you know, cause we came into Mosul right after the Marines left out. Right. So the Marines in 101st, had just cleared out of Mosul and we took over, you know. I've seen that process during war, you know, where it's kind of like, okay, things are still going on. And I've seen the war calm down over there, you know. So I've seen truly all the different facets of war, right? Minus being like day one, you know, when shock and awe was going on. That's the only thing I hadn't seen. But outside of that, though, you know, I've seen all these other different facets. And I say, well, I've never seen Afghanistan. I really was... excuse the expression, I was hell bent on wanting to go to Afghanistan because I wanted to get into that fight. But you know, my unit told me, and I think I talked to everybody, I even talked to the post commander and was like, hey, I've got to do this. Like, and everybody told me the same thing. They were like, you've served your time, man. We appreciate, you know, everything that you've done, but you know, it's time for you to take care of family. We understand that. And I said, I appreciate that, but I really want to go to this fight.
That's quite a statement of your patriotism. You did not shy away from it. Kind of reminds me of the motto of the Texas Rangers. And I think I've mentioned that to you over time. You know, Texas mm-hmm. Rangers, they don't run from a fight. They run to a fight.
To it. Yeah.
That's it. Exactly. But the fact is that, like I say, again, with the Afghanistan situation, there were some shrinking violence. People really didn't want to do it. But it's interesting that you wanted to do it. And the fact that, like I said, now you would have been taking over as an NCO, mm-hmm. risen to the rank of staff sergeant. And I want to go and speak real quickly to a little bit about your background with the JROTC. Like you did everything in life, you seized the bull by the horns. You were not only just in JROTC, you commanded a special unit within JROTC, Junior ROTC High School, for 3 years. What unit was that?
I was drill team commander while I was in JROTC. I got out as cadet lieutenant colonel.
For 3 years?
I finished high school as a cadet lieutenant colonel in JROTC. So like the leadership role in JROTC, I mean, the leadership that I had in that course really, really, really helped shape and mold, you know, my thinking process, you know what I mean? And really got me ready for service. I do have to give homage and pay respects to Colonel Flowers, Sergeant Major Boyd, and Command Sergeant Major Boyd, I'm sorry. Sergeant Cromartie, right? Who were my three instructors through that process. I mean, they really did teach me a lot. And with that, without them, you know, I know that, you know, they gave me the basics of the Army. So they truly prepared me, even though, you know, I was supposed to go through a college ROTC program, which I think I forgot to mention that earlier. I did do a semester of college. That's when September 11th happened and kind of changed the game on my career path. So, but they did prep me for college, ROTC, and they definitely prepped me for basic, you know, when I went through basic training.
So, one thing that I just want to point up also, again, consistent with seizing the bull by the horns, being a staff sergeant, you enjoyed a certain position that was reserved for a commissioned officer. And just speak very briefly about that, because I think you served with a general officer who actually supported you to go to officer candidate, OCS officer candidate school to become commissioned. What unit was that when you served with that general? Because like I say, you're a staff sergeant serving in a commissioned officer position. That's quite a step up. I can speak to that. And your leadership, your ability to adapt. Yeah, just speak to that very briefly.
Oh, that's so during my third deployment, actually my sergeant major from my third deployment was actually my first sergeant at my first duty, or he was one of the first sergeants in my unit at my first duty station, right? And he knew what we had been through on that deployment. He knew that I had another deployment after that one. And on my third one, he said, hey, man, I'm gonna give you a little bit of a break from all these patrols and stuff. I want you to work as a liaison for your unit, for the battalion. And I said, okay, cool. So I was the only sergeant E5 at the time in that role when all the other battalions from the brigade were lieutenants. So it took a lot of time and dedication in that position to, you know, I realized that at that moment I was like, these guys know this job and I'm just stepping into it. And when I got ready to get into that position, the guy that I did my switchover with, he was like 2 days out from leaving out of country. So it was basically a crash course in this is what you do.
Okay.
You know, so so
roll with the punches.
Yeah, exactly. So I ended up, you know, in 2 days learning the crash course on this new position that I'm going to be doing. And it took me literally working probably, I think, you know, my shift was started 8, but I would get there at like 7. You know, I was supposed to get off at 10, but I would leave at midnight sometimes. And I was doing that because I wanted to make sure that I learned that job as quick as I could, you know, so that the just little extra time of coming in and working on that job. And just to let you know, okay, so, you know, a lot of folks, they hear the, you know, oh yeah, you did LNO work. Would you schedule flights for the guys to come in and out or, you know, stuff like that? No, but I was actually coordinating a lot of different efforts for my battalion as far as ISR efforts, combat air support,
SEAL team,
any type of combat enablers, stuff like that. You know, I was doing a lot of that enabler work, right, to get the support to the units that needed it. So it, you know, it was like I said, it was a job that was scheduled for lieutenants to do that, but it was something that, you know, I, as a sergeant, I have no choice. Okay, my sergeant majors give me this tasking, you know, I can complain about it or I can get the job done. You know, that's the attitude that I had to get towards it. And which my I know you said general earlier, but no, my brigade commander at the time was impressed by the work that I was able to do. And, you know, several different times he gave me kudos on that. He said, you know, as a sergeant, I didn't know if this was going to be something that you could handle. But, you know, I see you can handle this with no problem. So, I mean, and it even got brought out in a couple of different meetings that, you know, hey, he's on it. You know, you're on it. You know, so it was good to hear that and get that support from my unit's command, you know, not just from my brigade commander, but also from my battalion commander and whatnot. So,
yeah, there was a lot put in your basket. I know that you referred once upon a time, I think, to maybe working with a SEAL team. Of course, you can't get into any particulars about what all is about. And then there was a very special unit that the military has that you kind of coordinated. So your stuff was high profile. And for a staff sergeant to do a commissioned officer's work at the level that you did it, like, yeah, that speaks a lot to your abilities, speaks a lot to your training, your motivation, the whole bit. Now, I'm curious. Now, we did mention Afghanistan, so I'm going to move along, coming up to the present day. Speaking of Afghanistan, what, and I know, and like I said, again, one other thing, in addition to our motto, amor civitatis, you know, love of community, we also have another kind of unwritten motto, speak the truth. Right. Pull out in Afghanistan. What's your feeling about that? I mean, hey, you're out of the military now, you know, you could speak. Speak it, brother, speak it. What was your impression of the pull out of Afghanistan?
Honestly, and I mean, I will definitely speak the truth on this, that the lack of planning in that process was evident. You know, it was apparent. I understand, and don't get me wrong, right? So one of the schools that I did do in the military was UMO. And UMO is Unit Movement Officer. Basically, in that school, you learn how to move a unit from point A to point B. Not just, you know, I mean, think about how much that entails. You know, I'm talking about everything from, you know, a soldier with this gear all the way to a fully loaded combat vehicle. You know, you're learning how to move all that stuff. The process is going to take to move that stuff from point A to point B. You know, you learn everything. A matter of fact, I remember day one of that school, you know, my my instructor said, first rule, shut up. I said it once, I won't say it again. Number two, 75% of you are going to fail this course. That's just the way it is, right? So, so you know, in that being said, he kind of set the standard for what was going to do. And I'm not going to lie to you, that was one of the, you know, mentally, I mean, school-wise, course-wise, I was like, that was a very difficult course because, you know, you're using 14 different manuals throughout that course and you got to think about, okay, cool. And I'm thinking about moving this one object from here to here, but I got to reference, you know, weights in this one. You know, I got to reference the other components of the vehicle in this one, you know what I mean? So there's a lot that goes into play. I know I kind of digress, but
no, that's okay. I mean, good feeling, good background.
Yeah. With that being said though, the move out of Afghanistan, you know, intelligence is something that we all rely on. And, you know, there's a lot of times that you get intelligence about what's going on in your battle space, right? And what happened with that, you know, the fact that we lost, I think it was 12 or 13 Marines, that should have never happened, you know?
Amen. That should
never happen. And number two, on that move out of Afghanistan, I mean, I don't think it was orchestrated the way that it should have been, honestly. You know, I understand they were pressed for time. I understand they had a deadline to meet, right? But lack of planning is ultimately an operational downfall. You know, we sit, and that's one thing I remember about being in the Army, is we sit and we rehearse, you know, and we think of every possible situation. You know, what's the best likely course of action? What's the worst course of action? You know, we take into account all of that. And, you know, it looked like we're trying to hurry up and get out of a country and not leaving out gracefully like we always do. You know, when the American Army or the American military comes into a battle space, right? When we hit with shock and awe, you know, we set the standard at that point that we're not to be fucked with. And then after that, you know, when we're leaving out the country, you know, it's normally a graceful leaving, like, hey, cool, we're done here. No, we're leaving out. That didn't happen this time. It looked like we were trying to hurry up and flee the country, which is the wrong impression that, you know, I think that we showed the world, because, you know, we're on the world's view. And to see that we're trying to hurry up and get all these flights out and hurry up and do this and hurry up and do that, you know, that's not the standard that we set when we leave a country.
Okay. Yeah, that's of course a lot of criticism over that. With my experience being a strategic and tactical planner, all the way up to the Pentagon Joint Chiefs, like that's what I did. I saw some of the same things. There was a checklist, but nobody bothered to follow it. They kind of put the checklist on the shelf and let's hurry up and do this. And that's not the way that we do that. Some people will say, just like I heard when I was in Southeast Asia, Vietnam, you know, the military commanders secretly, because they ain't crazy, they were secretly were saying, civilians, get out of the way and let us handle this situation type of thing. But obviously that's not going to happen. That's the way the American government is structured and all. So we go with that. So we kind of took that lump. But like I say, hopefully, like I say, there were lessons learned. And after any significant operation, like Southeast Asia, I had the privilege of working on a document, lessons learned, operational command, operational control of Marine air assets. And that's when the Marine Corps flew for the Air Force. They will never admit that. It's just a competition type of thing. They'll never say that they were under command of the Air Force, but they were. Right. And I have documentation. I did complete that extensive work for the Vice Chief of Staff of the Air Force, second ranking guy in the Air Force, and General McBride. So I know that's the truth. But there are plans, and there's also going to be after action reports. And the comments that you made, I'm sure, are shared by those above you, those who probably even trained you. So the next time, if there is going to be a next time, that won't ever happen again. But I really want to take it now to really, you know, just the present circumstance, present situation. And, you know, like it's kind of like the elephant in the room because of our motto, what we're talking about, the way I led into the program. The elephant in the room is, we call it J6. You may call it January 6, 2021. And those things that happen. You have some people who have a discussion. We had a very prominent attorney. Of course, it's somewhere along the way he had managed to get himself, you know, disbarred, but that's okay too. He'll get over it. But I characterized, surprisingly, during our conversation, I said, well, you know, the insurrection on January 6th, and he took umbrage. He took offense to that. He said, that wasn't an insurrection. Now I'm kind of worried about that. But anyway, January 6th, you saw it on TV. Everybody saw it on TV. And if you missed it, like it went off for weeks after that, they showed the activities there. What was your impression of what was happening? Your gut impression of what was happening?
I mean, J6 is a day that should never happen, right? To be honest with you, you know, that was, you know, we call it an insurrection, but you're looking at a mutiny trying to take place. Basically, you know, I understand we all have our different feelings about our politicians and leadership. Understand you're going to have loyalists and whatnot like that. And, you know, we saw the same thing in Iraq. You know, Saddam had plenty of loyalists all the way to the end, you know, and even afterwards, you know, there was plenty of loyalists that still stick around, you know, true believers of Saddam, you know. And same thing with bin Laden, you know, and not comparing, you know, our former commander in chief to that of those types. But you know, I understand, you know, these guys had it in their mind that, okay, cool, you know, the election was lost, but this is who we want to be president, right? Mm-hmm. If that's what you want, then there's different ways to do that. You know, help him out in the next time he runs for election or something like that. But to try to sit and overthrow the government, and I mean, it was a very poor orchestration of you know, people trying to get together and do something, number one. Number two, and I'm not supporting what they did at all. I actually find what they did very, very, very horrible. And I mean, it goes everything that I believe in. It goes against everything that I believe in. So with their actions on J6, I mean, I'm not in favor of them at all. You know, that was basically, you know, we call it an insurrection, but they were trying to basically, you know, act in a mutinous manner toward our government. That should not happen. Things like that should not happen. You know, there's been times in the past where people have tried to do that. There's been different situations where people have tried to do that same thing. And, you know, to perform any type of mutiny against your chain of command or your government, however you want to call it, you know, I can't support that. You know, an elected official is an elected official. You know, if you run for president and win the election, right, you know, with that military mindset, I mean, you support your new commander in chief, right? That, you know, these guys, and unfortunately, we did lose one American that day. I mean, that's very, very, very sad. And that should not have happened. That, you know, she should never been in that situation in the beginning.
Ashley Bennett, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So Ashley mm-hmm. Bennett should not have been in that situation in the beginning. I mean, the actions of that day should not have happened at all. You know, those actions never happened, Ashley Bennett would still be around. But I even heard that there was active duty military that was there on scene, and that there was a couple of different people that were trying to orchestrate the battlefield, basically. And that's not okay by any standard. You know, mm-hmm. you cannot do, you know, acts against the government are not okay with me. You know, you took an oath that says I'll protect our country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Well, you just became an enemy of the nation on that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so how are you supporting and defending? You know, is a question that I would ask those.
You bet. Yeah, you know, and there were active duty personnel that was actually you know, involved in that. Someone proudly represented themselves as being active duty servicemen. Also consistent with the blue and green hashtag, yeah, there were law enforcement individuals who actually were very proud of the fact that, and they would tell Capitol Police and the DC Metropolitan Police when they showed up, come on, join us, brothers. Yeah, we're really police officers type of thing. So what was your feeling about that, having been law enforcement?
No, I mean, and you're right, you know, serving in a law enforcement role, I mean, your basic responsibility is, you know, to protect and serve. How are you protecting and serving your nation, right, if you're out there encouraging an insurrection? I mean, that, you know, that is funny to me now. I mean, at the time it wasn't funny, but it's funny to me now because, you know, your basic responsibility is, you know, to protect and serve. So how are you accomplishing that if you're out there encouraging it? You know, if you're trying to embrace the people that's, you know, hey, come on with me, brother. Yeah, I'm with you. No, that's not your role. Your role is to protect and serve. You know, law enforcement should have shut that down so quick. And, you know, if it was any other city in the world, I'd understand, you know, if it takes a minute to get resources together and figure out the situation. But I mean, we're in DC, you know, you're in DC for crying out loud. I mean, DC is probably the most protected city in America, you know, with all the different assets and enablers there, right? So if it's a situation to where, you know, an insurrection is happening, you've got all these people on the Capitol steps, literally, you got people all over these other different spots in DC, you know, protesting and whatnot like that, and trying to gain ground, basically. I mean, why would it take so long for the police to shut that down? You know, I promise you this, and I know this for a fact, if there would have been an outside opposing force trying to, you know, conduct the same type of attack, basically, right? Or worse, on the White House, it would have been handled and shut down very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so what's the difference between handling that situation and what happened with J6?
You bet. You know, and it's interesting also because you had that the active duty military piece. Now, I stand corrected. It was Ashley Babbitt. I said Bennett, but I corrected myself. I referred to my notes saying Bennett didn't quite sound right, but Ashley Babbitt. So with all due respect, you know, posthumously, we want to recognize her for what happened. But now the military piece, some will state that, you know, and you know, in the military oath, you took the oath, the NCO oath is pretty close to what the commissioned officers take. You know, follow the orders, you know, support and defend the Constitution and those appointed over you. The commander in chief was the president. He was still commander in chief, although he was lame duck, but still, in fact, commander in chief. So what about those who their fallback position is we were under orders by our commander in chief? What's your feel about that? I think there was a certain creed that, you know, that kind of goes along with that every active duty serviceman or whatever. And I think that, gosh, I can't remember word for word, but I think that you had it committed because that's the type of soldier that you were, that you were and that you still are. You know, you never were formerly a soldier, you're always a soldier, you know, type of thing. Like say with the Marines, you're never a former Marine, you're always a Marine type of thing, soldier. But those who said, well, we're acting under the orders of the commander-in-chief of the president, where are the holes in that? You know, that can't be cut and dry. That can't be the truth.
Well, I mean, I can see, you know, where one would think, okay, my commander-in-chief has instructed me to do this. But at the same time, it's, you know, it comes with common sense and logic, right? Am I doing this, even though it's, you know, this is what is being hinted, because, you know, one thing about it, that there was never an order, an official order given today. I mean, it was implied, I guess, you know, in our former commander in chief's, you know, speech at a rally that he may have did that day or in days prior to that event. But at the same time, you know, it just goes with logic. Being a non-commissioned officer in the Army, I mean, we do live by a creed. And the very first line in that creed is no one is more professional than I. That's a very heavy statement in itself because, you know, you're taking into account, you know, your professionalism, right? And then, you know, there's other things in that creed as well that relate to the situation as well. You know, competence is my watchword. You know, where was the confident, you know, there was not, the actions are not justifiable to me for J6. You know, I can understand that, you know, people are mad because the person that they want to be or continue to be president is on his way out. I can understand where they're coming from on that, you know, but your actions were mutinous. Once again, you know, it was not a thought out process. You know, if you want an elected official to stay in power, you know, then there are certain things you can do. You know, help him run the next time that he runs, or campaign for him the next time that he runs. But you know, to try to take over D.C. is not a good idea. You know, that was not a good look for the nation. That does not show a nation together. That shows a nation divided. You know. And I don't support the decision that was made that day. I can't support that. You know, that's not acting in the best interest of our country, and that's not acting in, you know, into what we would consider to be, you know, a proper look for the nation.
You know, it's interesting because there were several countries, adversaries of ours, who seized on that very moment, not to mention the Russians, of course. The Chinese, the North Koreans, the Iranians, all of them seized on that moment. As like I say, the big bad United States, I get to look at them, you know, they're starting to crumble type of thing. And that was the message that was sent. But I'm kind of curious, being a former active duty, if they gathered up all the folks that were involved active duty wise in that insurrection, put them in a room, and you were able to address them, what would you say to them? What would you say to them? Just speaking the truth, what would you say to them? Because I think that there was a creed that I think that you repeated verbatim. I've heard it before too, that I would probably start off with that, but I don't know if you wanted to repeat that creed in its entirety or not, but it really sends a message that even the ones who are hell-bent on tearing down the present government and reinstalling a new republic, as someone referred to, if they heard that creed or maybe reminded that creed, I don't know, but I don't know if you remember or if you want to even go into that. But what would you tell that group gathered of all active duty people who had taken off their uniforms, put on the civilian clothes of the insurrectionists and then took off, but they still didn't relieve themselves of active duty, duties, et cetera. What would you say to them?
You know, there's no other way to say it. The first question, and this is just the staff sergeant to me, I mean, the first question I would ask them is, what the fuck were y'all thinking? Like, I mean, I don't understand where they would have that. You know, the one thing about it is the military feels that sense of discipline in you. And with that being said, I mean, it's just one of those things where your actions are constantly on watch. Your actions are constantly being monitored. Your actions are constantly being accounted for, right? And just like you said, I mean, you know, I won't say the creed verbatim right now. You know, we talked about it last night, and I did.
That's okay.
Verbatim for you. But I will take excerpts from the creed, and I mean, that's just, you know, the creed has always been something to live by. You know, and of course, it's the non-commissioned officer creed, the creed of the non-commissioned officer. But, you know, officers had their own creed. Soldiers had the soldier's creed. You know, we all live by a warrior ethos. I mean, I just don't understand what they were thinking. You know, this is not okay. You know, this is not appropriate action in the absence of orders. You know, this is that you're incurring. You know, this is not using confidence, and confidence is supposed to be your watchword. You know, this is not being professional, and you're supposed to live by no one is more professional than I. You know, I mean, how are you living by these creeds, and your actions are not accounting for who you're supposed to be as a person? You know, that's what I don't understand. I don't understand how anybody would think it's okay to want to go ahead and take this type of action into, you know, a very poorly orchestrated attempt, you know, to either demonstrate protest or overthrow the government in a single day. No, that's not okay. I can't support that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you say support and defend the nation against all enemies, foreign and domestic, but now you become the enemy.
Mm. How could they resolve that?
Right, exactly.
You bet. Now let's replace that active duty group. Now, there were several, as I pointed out, they're now incarcerated. Well, I think the number's up to, 400 or 600 that have been incarcerated over this. Now you replace them. Your new meeting is with the active duty, active law enforcement personnel, because there's a law enforcement oath of honor that's taken. It varies from state to state in the phraseology, but basically says the same thing. So once again, what they did flew in the face of that oath that they took. I mean, there is a law enforcement oath of honor that I'm aware of, you know, type of thing. So what would you say to that group? You know, and that's putting on your other hat. You just took off your active duty hat. They can put on your law enforcement hat. What would you say to that group?
I mean, basically the same thing. You know, I would start off the same way with what were you guys thinking? I mean, it's you know, like I said earlier in the interview, your basic responsibility of law enforcement is to protect and serve. You know, no matter where you go through or go to in this nation, you know, the basic responsibility of law enforcement is to protect and serve. You know, to help out your people in your community. You know, we call it policing because policing is to clean up, you know, and that's the basic responsibility of the police, you know, clean up, you know, when a situation is going awry, you know, when someone needs help, be there for that. But if you're in law enforcement and you're part of that crowd, I mean, you can't say that you didn't know. Your job as a law enforcement, you know, officer, official, whatever you may want to call it, is to protect, serve, and know the law. So you can't say, well, I didn't know I couldn't do this, because that's your job. Your job is to know the law.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things where I just don't, you know, I don't understand what the logic was, where this was, okay, this is going to be a good idea, well, let's do this.
That's a classic expression. Ignorance of the law is no excuse.
Exactly. And I mean, honestly, you know, for people that have taken action like that, you know, whether they were active military or, you know, actively serving as a law enforcement official, I mean, those jobs, I would not, if I was in the chain of command, I could not leave those people. Once they were identified, I could not leave them in those positions of responsibility.
Okay.
That's something that has to be taken away, because you're, you know, how are you living by example? And that's one thing that as law enforcement or military that you're, you know, you're trained to do, is live by example. And granted, nobody's perfect, but when you have something on a national scale going on, you know, that's not right. I mean, you can't leave that person in that position, because then you're encouraging it, or you're not, you're saying, you know, you just set a new standard and said, this is okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not okay.
Gotcha. You know, it's interesting, while you're in active duty, when you're on active duty, there are certain concepts that are entertained by certain active duty personnel. They don't necessarily act out on them, as they did in the case of J6, but you may have been aware of that. And as you hear different things or whatever, what was your reaction to that? Like, as an example, I was watching a CNN special that kind of documented racism in the military, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, dissension within the ranks, et cetera. And I heard a startling figure. They were stating that at Fort Bragg, of course, you know, home of the special operations, you know, Green Berets, et cetera, they had estimated up to about 10% of them within the Green Berets identify with skinheads. And if that doesn't fly in the face, you know, but again, so you may hear this or you may even see this. Now, of course, some of your deployment or some of your active duty assignments, you're over in Germany, I think, bomb holder Germany type of thing. So you got a chance to interact there with, of course, the military police, and then also the German civilian police as well. So you got a chance to interact there. But when you're over there in Europe, a lot of times people will get dissuaded by whatever's going on within that country type of thing. So I didn't know, what was your reaction? Did you hear a lot of that? Go ahead.
I mean, yeah, it's something that's not talked about, I think, as much as it should be talked about. But is there racism in the military? I mean, I will, you know, since we're speaking the truth, I will say that there is, you know. Is there, I mean, there's all types of things that go on that people don't really realize or is talked about a lot, you know. Now, don't get wrong, I will say this, there are good commanders out there. You know, there are good NCOs out there. There is good law enforcement out there. No, I don't think that everybody's the enemy, right? But
okay.
In every bunch, you're going to have a bad apple. You know? And that's pretty much, I mean, you know, if you think about it with that logic, you know, we try to nip things in the bud as fast as we can, you know? And that's one thing I say about, you know, about the Army from my experience. You know, don't get me wrong, I've had, you know, a couple of encounters and conversations with people and whatnot. And I've had some different, you know, soldiers and NCOs that I worked with, where you can, you know, through conversation with them, you know, it's prominent and precedent, you know, the type of person they really are. But I don't. So with that being said, it's like this, you know, the difference is, I know somebody, as a matter of fact, that I know for a fact did not like me because of, you know, either my race, color, or whatever it may have been.
Okay.
At the same time, though, even though that was the case, when the theoretical shit is hitting the fan, you know, he's right there next to me ready to fight.
Okay. That's good proof. That's proof in the pudding.
And that's, you know, that's part of being brothers. You know, that's part of being brothers. Even though we may have our differences, and, you know, I'm, you know, just because of who I am by skin color, he may not, you know, may not like me for whatever reason. And it might be something personal. I've had some people divorce to me because they've had past experiences or whatever the situation may be, and this is the reason why they feel like this tour is this group of people. I tell them all the time, don't judge this group of people by one.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you're asking me not to judge you for who you are.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Or judge your group of people for who you are. You know, so don't do the same thing to me. Don't judge, you know, me for something that somebody else has done.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, is, you know, is racism present there? Yeah. Is sexual discrimination present there? Yeah. Is there hazing and stuff like that that goes on sometimes? Yeah. Or, I mean, at least I could say it was when I was in, but at the same time, it's things that we deal with, you know, but at the end of the day, we put those differences aside to execute the mission. Where we have problems is when there's people out there that don't understand that the mission comes first and want to make it all about that situation, that they are, you know, and their personal beliefs, right? Then you're going against the creed again because, you know, you're not supposed to use it for pleasure, profit. You know, you don't use a greater position for pleasure, profit, or personal safety. That just goes without saying.
Okay.
But you have individuals that will try to use their influence that they have from their greater position to attain their personal objectives. And that's not okay. You know, like I said, it's not all. I can't say it's all, but is there groups of people in there in the military that's like that? Yeah, there is.
You bet.
So does the Army or the military do everything they can to try to weed out those individuals and get them out of there? Yeah, they do. You know, I can say that from my personal experience. But, you know, every chain of command is different. Every unit is different.
Exactly. That's a pretty good statement. I like the way you addressed that situation, especially with the J6, the things that should have been on their mind, the things that you would have told them. That's very pertinent. Just as we begin to close out, though, and I do appreciate your presentation, I appreciate your words. Just I want to put something in a nutshell. When you were active duty military, did you ever have any adverse run-ins with local law enforcement? You know, and of course, you know what I'm going to do. The follow-on question of that would be, you know, when you left the military, but active duty wise, what was the relationship? I know you were pretty much up in military communities around Fort Lewis. That's pretty much a military type of town. What was the relationship with civilian law enforcement and the military that you perceive?
You know what? I will say that overall, now don't get me wrong, I've had my few experiences where they were negative in manner. I remember, for example, when I was at Fort Lewis, a buddy of mine, we knew some friends that were going to have a party. And, you know, one night we were getting ready to go to the party with them. And he had some type of vehicle issue to where the car broke down en route. And I remember, you know, that we were like, okay, cool. We're not that far from probably a gas station or something like that. So we'll just start walking, you know, and see if we can get some type of help or something like that, right? To come out and help us. And we start walking. We actually see a cop car pass by, a police car pass by, and we start waving our hands like, hey, 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 you know, we need help. And I'll never forget, the cop car jumped probably about, you know, he hit his gas for about maybe a good 5 to 10 feet, slammed on the brakes, and both of the cops jumped out with guns drawn on us. Now, my friend and I were both Black or African-American, and we're both, you know, I think we're both PSCs at the time, private first class in the Army at the time. You know, so we immediately throw our hands up, say, hey, whoa, 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 you know, PSC Davis, United States Army. And my friend responds off with his rank and his last name, you know, and we say, hey, we just need help. And the cops, you know, tell us to get on our knees. And we're like, what's going on, man? Like, it's not that type of, you know, not the type party, but we get on our knees, they come around, they search us, They ask us what's going on, ask us what are we doing in that type neighborhood, you know, and basically let us know that, you know, they're not used to African Americans being around that type neighborhood.
Gotcha.
You know, at that time of night. So like I said, you know, there's not, you know, to that situation of going any, you know, going to a worst case scenario, maybe. But I mean, I was just fortunate enough to get out of that situation and, you know, come out of that situation unharmed. You know, I've had several instances where, you know, like when I was in Colorado, you know, I got pulled over a couple times just because of the car that I was driving in. But
okay.
You know, but you know, the funny thing about it is, honestly, you see that stuff outside of, you know, I'm from Alabama. And being back home, the funny part about it for me is that in Alabama, I've never really been pulled over for anything like that.
Okay.
I have been, you know, in Colorado and Washington State, which, you know, historically speaking, I mean, the South, you know, has its past and has its history. So you would think that that would probably be something that would be, you know, more to worry about here back at home in Alabama. But now, you know, I remember I was running late for a job interview here in Alabama, and I was speeding, right? I stopped. Cop came up to the window. I explained exactly what was going on, and I'm like, hey, man, I messed that up. I'm sorry, I was speeding. I'm running late for this job interview. And he was like, hey, you know what? Have a nice day, man, and let me go.
Okay.
You know? So it's funny how, you know, in the South, I haven't really encountered it here at home like I did in other states. You know, but the relationship, oh, I'm sorry. I know I kind of digressed off of the question, but the relationship with military law enforcement, I mean, there's some things that go on. You know, I saw not that long ago on the news that a lieutenant there got pulled over, and I'm not okay with that. I mean, this guy's an active duty uniform. And
Lieutenant Karen Nazario.
Exactly. And he's asking, you know, why am I getting pulled over? He just wants to know why.
Okay.
Know? And here's the thing about that. I will say this, right? And I've been on both sides, right? I've been a deputy sheriff, right? And me, I would give common courtesy and respect to people and say, hey, you know, the reason I stopped you is because your tail light's out. Or the reason I stopped you is because you're doing 75 to 25. You know, the reason I stopped you is this. So, you know, I introduced myself. Hey, my name is Deputy Davis. This is the reason why I stopped you. You're doing 75 to 25. Can I see your license and registration, please? Right? Now that person knows, right? But a lot of times these guys come up to these windows, these cars, right, wearing this badge on their chest and flexing because they have a uniform on, you know, and think that because I have a uniform on, I can talk to people the way that I want to talk to them or whatever like that. No, there's still a level of decency and respect that you have to show to people.
Okay. I was just curious. So just real quickly, just flipping the script once again. Now, as a law enforcement side, did you ever have any interactions with the active duty military? You know, and I think you probably partially answered that one. But just kind of curious that now that, you know, not that you can, you know, get retribution or anything like that, not that, but now that you're on the other side, and since we're talking about, you know, I say blue and green, that's, you know, kind of our podcast show, as law enforcement, any negative interactions or interactions at all with active duty military personnel?
No, you know what? I've never ran across it.
Okay.
I'll be honest with you, you know, a lot of times, when you come across veterans and whatnot, and when you come across, you know, people that may be active duty, I mean, it's a lot of professional courtesy that's displayed, you know.
Should be, yes.
And you know, like I said, in every bunch there's going to be one bad apple, you know. There may be somebody that's ticked off because you pulled them over, and that's understandable. That may not be because of the uniform that you wear or they wear, you know. But that's just that person being ticked off about the situation. But I can say that, you know, in my personal experience, have I ever encountered that? No, I haven't. It's always been, you know, but it's also the level of professionalism that you display when you encounter somebody.
Okay.
You know, and I mean, outside of the, you know, outside of what I do for work on a regular basis now, I'm also a certified life coach. And, you know, we one of the things that you talked about, or that we talk about in when you're going through your certification to become a life coach, is, you know, active listening and active communication, you know. And when you communicate with people, you know, you're setting the tone for how everything else is going to play out in that situation.
Okay. You bet.
And that's what a lot of people don't understand. You know, a lot of these situations could be diffused if people would just say, you know, whatever chip they have on their shoulder, set that to the side and say, hey, look, this is the reason why I pulled you over. You know, a lot of times the lack of communication that, you know, if you watch a lot of these videos, people know that if you don't tell them something, that is going to make that person act a certain way. You're going to incite that person a certain way, right?
Okay.
So if I ask you, if you pull me over and say, and I ask you, why am I getting pulled over? And you just say, license and registration. And I ask you again, okay, before I show you my license and registration, you know, why am I getting pulled over, right? Why not just answer the question?
Gotcha. It's just that simple, that simplistic and all. But I tell you what, I've thoroughly enjoyed this podcast. When I went into it, I know you were kind of pressed because you had to, you know, somebody got to go to work, so pay the bills. Okay. But I'm glad that it developed the way that it did. You certainly held to my personal creed, that is speak the truth, and you've done that. You've done that very well. Like I said, again, you've characterized a lot of the current events, you know, spoke specifically, directed J6, which had to happen. The relationships between the military vis-a-vis law enforcement and vice versa, law enforcement vis-a-vis military. You've spoken to that too. And you've held yourself up well. And I'm very proud of you. Very, very proud of you. I haven't said that enough. I am. And I do appreciate this podcast show. I could possibly see like maybe a future endeavor where we can kind of get a little bit more time if we won't be pressed for time. But as once again, as a good NCO, you manage your time very well. So I just wanted to say from the production staff of the show. And again, our show, once again, the podcast show is hashtag blue and green, with the blue being, of course, the law enforcement partners, green being the active duty military or even, you know, retired military partners as well. It's the hashtag blue and green podcast show. Now, our website platform, for those who are interested and who are listening in, the website platform is www.afvets.net. And that is spelled out phonetically, www.A as in Alpha, F as in Foxtrot, B as in Victor, E as in Echo, T as in Tango, S as in Sierra.net. That's our website platform. Twitter, you get us at lowercase at Air Force Vets. So we were able to reserve that one. So, and we encourage people to go to that, to get in contact with us, you know, and give us some feedback on what you think of the show. Or if you want to just go ahead and get in contact with us to find out more about what it is that we're doing, what it is we're about, we would like to use this as a platform to really start a movement, you know. And again, we take Amoris Civitatis, our motto, love of community, very close to heart, because once again, you know, where we have failed is we have a repeat of January 6, 2021, and that can't happen. And I think we've emphasized that. So once again, former Staff Sergeant Jamal Darren Davis, we appreciate your participation. We appreciate your service to the country and appreciate your service to the community as a deputy sheriff. So thank you so very much for all that you've done. Thank you so much.